One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. It's movement time in Detroit this week, so I thought it would just be perfect to get the one only Kevin Saunderson on. Kevin Saunderson really needs no introduction at all. He has been the pioneer pretty much from day one in techno from Detroit, along with Juan Atkins, Derek May, Jeff Mills, Carl Craig, all of the pioneers in this industry. I had an amazing conversation with him, and I am excited for you to listen. So without further ado, Kevin Saunderson. Kevin Saunderson, what's going on, man?
Hey, what's up? What's happening?
How are you?
Man, I'm all right. I can't complain. Just got back from a road trip for Toronto.
Nice.
Did a performance out there. Played Detroit this past weekend. So I'm home.
Did you play Spotlight?
Yep, I played Spotlight on Friday, the anniversary.
I heard it was really good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I like that place.
It's a cool venue, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely, definitely.
How was Toronto? Was it good?
Toronto was good. I did an inner-city show. It's a smaller venue, but I must say it was packed, and it was a good show. I hadn't done inner-city in Toronto in years, yeah. So... It was nice too, because we didn't fly, we drove up, all that. So it was real relaxing. It felt like it was just connected to Detroit, like almost being like at home.
It's super easy, the fact that you can drive to Toronto from here. It's only like 4 hours, isn't it? Something like that.
That's a beautiful thing.
Were you doing, when you do in a city, do you do it live or is it DJ?
Yeah, it's live. I mean, we have components. We take the studio on the road, me and Dantes. And, we play on top, we arrange, when we have our singer, Stephanie, who's quite dynamic in her performance. Mm. And then, I have a keyboard player that sometimes I take, Nico from Detroit. And a percussion person too. So,
cool, man.
We do it a few different ways.
Yeah, man. First of all, thank you for coming on. It's an absolute pleasure to sit down with you. And I know we've kind of come across each other during on festivals. San Diego. I think I met you first in San Diego last year.
Right.
Across. Yeah. And obviously, I've been a fan for many years, and you've literally been one of the pioneers of the industry since day one.
Been a long time, been in the game a long time,
man, a very long time. And you've I'm pretty sure you've got some good stories for us all. But I kind of want to go back to the beginning. I was going through, I was doing some research, and I didn't realize, tell me if this is wrong as well. I didn't realize you were actually born in New York.
Oh, I was born in Brooklyn, Flatbush. I grew up in Flatbush. So yes, I'm born right there, Kings County Hospital, right?
And then came to Detroit like 10 years later?
Yeah, like it was elementary. It was definitely elementary school, like fourth, fifth grade.
Yeah.
I came and I lived in Inkster. That's where my mother grew up and most of her family was. So I lived in Inkster for a minute. And then by the time it was junior high days, I moved to Belleville.
How was it, Detroit, back then? What year are we talking?
Oh, man. Telling my age now. It had to be late 70s, 78, 76, somewhere right around.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it was different because New York was, you know, a lot more busier, more going on. You know, New York was a lot more dirtier too back in those days. It was, New York was just mixed. I lived on a street called East 28th Street. You know, you had Jamaicans, you had American, you know, blacks, you had whites, you had whatever, all kinds, Jews, Italians, just everybody on the same block, you know. So I was used to seeing just kind of everybody. So when I moved to Ames, it was quite different. It was like, it was all black.
Yeah.
I mean, so I wasn't even used to that. Even though I'm black, but I was used to being around kind of everybody.
Yeah.
So that was a bit different. That was a bit of an adjustment for me. And then I moved to Belleville, which was reverse of all that. You know, it was 98% just white.
White people,
you know. You know, it was an interesting time. You know, but it, you know, Inkster was. It was, you know, the suburb of Detroit, of course, but it was nothing like a city. And Belleville was completely country, you know, when you started doing stuff like fishing and, you know, playing sports. That's when I got into sports because there was nothing to do in Belleville, really.
Were your parents in the motor industry?
No, they actually wasn't. My father was in the real estate.
Okay.
And a bit of a hustler, too, in New York. And my mother... she went to nursing school and going to University of Michigan and getting her, I think she got her master's and it's a nursing instructor.
Nope.
I told my son not to call me. I was in an interview, but he didn't check his
text.
And I got, sorry, I got, what do you call it? Where he can break through, you know, my kids. I got to put it on airplane mode right now. Okay. There we go.
It's all good.
Sorry about that.
No, it's all good.
Got to do an edit.
It's all good. Doesn't matter.
So no, they weren't in the motor industry.
That's interesting that they came to Detroit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my father came because of my mother. Obviously, my mother went to New York and met my father, and, you know, I was born and all that.
Yeah.
But my mother was native from Detroit. You know, she was born in Detroit. So she really just came back to where she grew up.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. And then how did the whole you getting into music in Detroit back then start? I know you probably answered this question so many times, but I know people were probably interested in this listening now.
Yeah, it was a... gradual process, you know. First of all, when I moved to Detroit, I wasn't like into music like that. I just listened to what my mother played in the car. Mainly it was Motown, soul music, whatever. So New York radio, I listened a little because sometimes they play that in the car. When I moved to Belleville, I went to a middle school called North Junior High.
Yeah.
And playing on the football team, and I met Derek May on the, because he played football, and Aaron Atkins, which is Juan Atkins' brother.
Okay.
We were all in seventh grade. Juan was in ninth grade. So I didn't really connect with Juan at that time, but I met Juan at his house through his brother, saying, like, come through, come on and hang out, whatever, come to the crib. So that's kind of how that part started. And Juan had like little gadgets, like cassette decks, and pieces of equipment, maybe a synthesizer. I didn't even understand what it was at the time, but it looked interesting. So it caught my eye. So through time, knowing Juan and bumping into him every now and then, seeing him in school, and obviously he was older than us, so he was in ninth grade, so he was only in that school for about a year.
Yeah.
But Derek became really close to Juan and became, you know, kind of like a protege, you know, was into the theory of technological innovations, and the future, about making music for the future, because Juan had this concept. Now, I wasn't locked into it at that time, but it all came to me slowly over the years. And then Juan started creating music with Cybertron. That started. That kind of was like the beginning. Juan is the beginning of all of it.
100%.
Of techno. So, you know, then I started, Derek moved with me in high school for a half a semester, the second half of the year. And all kind of stuff going on in my studio. I'm in the studio now, so I, you know, somebody's at the door and lets me know, blah, blah, blah.
It's all good, man.
But anyway, okay, so.
Yeah, so you were talking about Juan, when Juan was getting into it.
Yeah, so when Derek moved in with me, that's kind of when my music education became, you know, it went up a level, because Derek was following Juan or helping Juan was his protege and wanted to make music at some point. He didn't, you know, he wasn't making music at this point, but that's when I started listening to the Electronic Mojo. Became more aware.
That was a radio station, right?
Say it again.
Was that a radio station? Yeah.
Mojo was this disc jockey that played music. It's called the Midnight Funk Association. Played it at 12 o'clock midnight, and he would play a collage of different music, electronic music, funk, Parliament Funkadelic, Prince, and he would play albums. So you fall in love with the artist, because you know regular radio, they just play what they thought was the hit or the singles, and you would only hear one or two from the album usually. But he had this unique way of playing music and educating people, and it included Juan's Cybertron. So I fell in love with Juan's music, not because I knew him, but because I thought it was innovative. And it sounded very futuristic. And so that was kind of my first beginning. And then, you know, I wasn't trying to make music. I was an athlete. I played sports, really, and just kind of was around those guys every now and then. Yeah. And, you know, I would later, I did this graduation party at my house. I had this nice house in Belleville and a pool, you know, just it was laid out. Back then, my parents had built this house. So as we graduated, I had the whole house to myself. My mother sold the house and moved. And Juan came to DJ. I got Juan and Derek. I didn't know Derek really was a DJ, but, you know, basically Derek was DJing at this party. And it was so cool because you had people from Detroit who were following Juan. They were starting to build this deep space. It was an organization called Deep Space that Juan had created. And people would follow him from Detroit, people from Cass Tech, Cooley, and they would just come to his events when he DJed. He's playing this first time I seen Juan DJing. So I was really impressed. And it kind of just took off from there, because at that age, I went back to New York in the summertime. And then I got to experience people like Larry Levan start going to Paradise Garage.
Wow.
So through the combination of going to the Paradise Garage, hearing Juan play, Tony Humphries at the Zanzibar, because I was kind of caught between New York and Detroit, you know? And as I went to college, I went to Eastern, I started learning about people like Al Lester. I started going to Cheeks.
Yeah.
And had guys around me that were playing music on campus. And it was cool because I was hearing, like, you know, electronic music. I was hearing, you know, disco, and I was into a lot of disco as well because, you know, just it's part of my nature about going back and forth to New York. So eventually I was playing football on the football team, and I was connected with a few of Derek's friends that were on East at Standard Eastern, and they were DJs. So I would kind of hang out when I had time and watch them on the Technique 1200s and listen to the music. So I kind of was absorbing all that. Yeah. At the same time, Derek was had moved to Chicago.
Okay.
Juan was having a success with Cybertron and the beginnings of Model 500, Technicolor, stuff like that. So I'm just really absorbing it and around it. Yeah. I didn't really step into the game until 83 was my first thought of like, I think I want to be a DJ.
So what year did Cybertron come out?
Cybertron was 79.
I didn't know it was that early.
It was before Shark. I don't know if you know about Charivari. That track. It was a little bit before that. They both came out in the same year. Juan was a few months or so before Cybertron. And, you know, that was kind of the beginning of techno.
He was like,
you're getting this debate.
Well ahead of the game.
Yeah, definitely. And then some people, you know, they get in the debate and they say like, oh, no, techno started in Germany. Started in... You know, because you got Kraftwerk and you got some electronic groups, but there's a difference between being an electronic band and what Juan with the creation of techno.
Yeah.
And nobody used that term to identify their music. So as Juan always say, I didn't say I was the creator of electronic music. I say I'm the originator of techno music. And what we did collectively is, even though Juan is the beginning, Derek was quite important bringing us all into the picture. People like me, people like Big Baxter, people like Eddie Folks, San Antonio came in through me. And these were all the beginning, you know, this is the beginning when we first did the compilation.
Totally.
But we took that sound and shaped it collectively into a DJ-based music that people could dance to, because there was a void in the market of really four on the floor and music that, you know, people could dance to.
Yeah
sure, Kraftwerk had records, New Order had electronic records, they were bands. There were other groups out there, and the house kind of was parallel. It was like a few months or so later, you know, the house movement. You know, so that's kind of the connection. I came into it, and I was a go-getter. I played sports, and I always wanted to be the best. I was humble, and I did my thing, and I came in it multiple ways. I just enjoyed vocal music as well.
Yeah.
I wanted to make something with vocals, but I also wanted to do stuff that was darker and deeper and faster. So I had kind of two sides to me, where some guys was only one way, straight path. My path was different. I was caught between doing a housier sound, a tech house sound, which is really a combination of a little bit of Detroit and Chicago and techno.
Well, tech house back then and for many years previous to what it is now is very different. I think that's a really interesting thing to bring up, is that how, if you go listen to old tech house, it is literally a mixture of house music and techno, which makes sense. And you hear all the synth elements and everything like that. How was it when you started and you wanted to make like more vocal records and then also more like techno records? Was the scene then? Because nowadays it's really tough to kind of do that. You almost pigeonhole to a certain extent. How was it then?
Well, I just kind of did what I felt, and I've had success both ways. You know, I was fortunate. I didn't get tied into being Mr. Commercial, even though I had commercial success within the city.
Yeah.
My first record was a vocal record. It was called Triangle Love by Cream.
Yeah.
And you know, the fact that I had my own label, you know, we all started our own labels, at least myself, Juan, and Derek, we all had our own label. So it gives you control over what you, you know, your what kind of music you release.
Yeah.
So I've always, KMS has always been you know, not one way, you know, and Kevin Sonnenson has been one way. Now I've created different aliases, probably too many aliases back then.
I was going through all your aliases and I was like, damn, these are a lot of fucking aliases.
Yeah. I mean, that was just, I had a lot of energy. I wanted to release. I wanted Detroit to seem like it was more acts out. People didn't know, like, Kevin Sonnenson did Baseline or my Reese stuff. They didn't know, you know, it was connected to me. They didn't know, like, E-Dancer, you know, they didn't, you know, some people didn't know, you know, they just didn't know because it was, you know.
Well, you didn't have the internet then, did you?
No, not at all. but there was there was space in the market for all. I had success with Reach Project, which is my more soulful, more like deep house type of vibe. So I had it from Inner City to E-Dancer to Tronic House, all that stuff was good for me, you know. It was a good time in the market. And you had the scene back then, it evolved because, you know, people from Europe started being inspired from, you know, Detroit and Chicago. But, you know, there's a lot of inspiration from Detroit. That's how the BPMs and stuff got faster, because we were a little bit faster, yeah. You know, BPM in a different type of energy. And then before you know it, you had London with the breakbeat scene, then yeah. The jungle scene kicked in, and then Germany was really rough and banging, you know, and faster, much faster. So, but yeah, I mean, I was able to do all of anything I wanted to do, I did, and had success at it. You know?
That's amazing. When you first started out, when was it a realization that you're like, this is what I want to do? Was it a quit? Let's stop playing football. Let's like stop everything and let's just concentrate on music.
You know, it moved pretty quick for me.
Yeah.
Because I was playing football. I mean, my first year in college was 82, and I was on the football team. So September to you know, for the rest of the year, you know, when football season is over, you go to spring football, yeah. You know, so that's kind of the off season, January, February, March. I tell you, by March, by the time we had our spring game, maybe in April, I realized that, first of all, the people that recruited me got fired. So now, you know, you're dealing with politics and the new coaching staff. And I could tell I didn't fit in their plans, but I was still on the team. But at the same time, I was hanging out with Art Payne and Keith Martin and Eddie Folks, people that were DJs. I was out with people like that. And just by being around them, I could feel the need for me to change my path. You know, never was a quitter. I didn't quit anything, really. I always, you know, just stuck with it. So I knew.
Yeah.
And by that time, by April, the spring game, after we had our spring game, they put up like who makes the team. I didn't even go look to see if I made the team what they wanted to keep me. I just felt like it was time for a change, and I wasn't feeling the connection. So right then I knew, you know, and I started out DJing, and it took me a while, but I worked at it just like sports. I had the work ethic of practicing. And while the people were sleeping, I was practicing, getting my work in. I was learning, and it just evolved from being a DJ to taking a drum machine to your gigs, mixing it with your music, to now putting a bass line to it, learning about sequencing. And over that time, from 83 to my first record came out actually on Metroplex, 86, I was developing, you know, from being a DJ into a producer, into an artist. And by the time 87 got here, which was 35 years ago, basically, I started my label. And once I did that, I was really off and running.
And was that KMS?
Yep, KMS Records. Yep, 35 years. So 35 years.
It's been going a while.
Yes, it has.
How does it feel looking back over the last 35 years of your career and seeing what you've achieved when it comes to life?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the dream of doing what you love has definitely come true for me, because I fell into the path of making electronic music and becoming an electronic artist, producer, record company, businessman. I was able to control a lot of my future. And yeah, I think if I didn't have that control, things would be different. So, and to see that the scene has evolved, you know, I had this vision even back then when I was creating music, and I felt like Detroit music, Chicago music, house music, dance music was the future.
Yeah.
Because I was on college, and you see like these fraternities, like, you know, I was in a fraternity, but you had, you know, it was a little more segregated then, black fraternities, white fraternities, whatever, right? But the white fraternities, you would walk by, they had these huge gatherings at the frat houses and outside, and it would be like 2,000 people there.
Yeah.
And then I keep saying, like, what kind of music are they listening to? What? And I liked all music, but to me, it felt like you needed dance music at these events. Yeah. And I felt like our music that we were creating fit in, but nobody would, at that time, would knew about us or could even accept it, understand our music.
Yeah.
And so I always thought that music of the future was our music, was dance music, was this new electronic music to make people dance. And it was for everybody. It wasn't for, you know, back then it was the only black people listening to this music and partying to the music.
Yeah.
So the future came true. We look years later, the world is dancing as one. We might have different genres, but it evolved in a way where the vision was right. And to see that happen over time is quite amazing, and see how many people have come up inspired by Detroit or Chicago, the music that we created, how it changed history, it made history, it created lots of money for a lot of people too, and built artists that grew out of this, you know? So it's quite amazing, you know, to see that happen over time and still be doing it years later, not knowing that, you know, I would be around 35 years later from the beginning of my label and still at it strong.
Well, I think it's pretty amazing as well how long you've been doing it for. I think a lot of people come into this, the music industry, and kind of expect like a strong, like 5 years. And then leave. And I think what Stacey, what Juan, what Derek, what all like MK, like all these kind of people that have been there from the very early days, in the pioneering days, proves that you can have a full on life of music, and you can just really just keep pushing on, and you have your ups and downs, and just keep doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. If it's what you love and you truly believe in it, you have to keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I know for me, I was blessed to be talented enough to have this vision, to be a part of something so amazing. And it's within me. So I can only do nothing but keep moving forward and keep doing what I love doing.
Love that, man. What was your first commercial success? What was it when you were like, okay, this is it, we're in it for the long run now?
Oh, when Inner City hit and I went to England and I started doing these TV shows, like
top
TV shows, Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And I'm on shows with Diana Ross, Chaka Khan, thinking like, why they got me on shows? And people like, these people are stars. But, you know, England looked at it as, you know, if your record was popular, you fit in. And, that's what it was. That's what the show was for. So I realized, but when I started doing stuff like that and doing concerts where it was 80,000 people performing on stage at Wembley Stadium and stuff like that.
Wow.
I had this feeling that this was it. This is going to be for the long haul. And this is definitely, you know, worth putting in the effort and getting a lot of rewards out of it. So I knew, you know, that I would be in it to the very end.
Yeah.
I'm still in it.
I want to talk about the whole inner city project and how it started and also how it's evolved to what it is today. What made you want to start inner city, and kind of, was it just you that was involved at the beginning, or was it the whole crew?
So in the beginning, like I say, I'm probably the only one in Detroit at that time that had this vision of doing vocal records as well.
Yeah.
So me and a schoolmate, James Pendleton, actually went to Belleville High School. So we had to have a Belleville four. He would be the fourth. I don't know how many people know that, but he went to Belleville. He was a little younger, but he was a part of the movement as well at that time, when myself, Eddie, Blake, because, you know, we all connected and we kept in contact. So me and James actually created the first inner city record, which was Big Fun.
That was the first one.
Big Fun was the very first record for inner city. But it was instrumental at that time. We just created it just in my studio, and which was basically the apartment at the time. And, you know, we just, you know, the way we did music back then, we would share equipment because we didn't have a lot.
Yeah.
So you know, James might have a piece or two. I have two pieces. Derek have a piece. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we just bring our stuff and we just be in one place and we create something. The other guys playing games on, you know, on not computers, but, you know, they had, I don't know what they had, like, I don't even know what we was playing back then. But anyway, we played games with other people making music. So me and James made Big Fun. We made Big Fun. It was instrumental. And then I kind of took it from there and started developing even more. And I brought in Paris, which is the original singer, Paris Gray, from Chicago.
Yeah.
Because we were connected with the Chicago guys a lot, like Farley and Chippy and Mike Hitman Wilson. So a guy named Terry Housemaster Baldwin at the time, he came to my studio and he was listening. You know, we play stuff to each other, you know, just playing your reels. And so he was checking it out. And he was the one that said, I have my singer. You should let her throw down on this. She would kill this. And because I like vocals, of course, let's see what she about, you know. So that's how I connected with Paris. Kind of gave her a vision, like, you know, I'm a very positive guy. I like to keep things. I don't want to be talking about love and sex, and let's keep it either spiritual, uplifting, fun, you know, happiness, think of that. And, you know, musically, I try to be the same way.
Yeah.
So she wrote the perfect song for Big Fun, you know, for the music at the time. So that was created. It was on the compilation album, the Detroit Techno. It was the last record to make the Detroit compilation. It wasn't even going to be on there, but I was releasing it anyway. It was coming out on my label, and I, you know, started floating it out at a certain time. But it made it because Derek May was supposed to turn in one more track, and he didn't create this last track. And Neil Rushton, who curated this whole thing with Derek, heard Big Fun and thought, we got to put this on the record. So it made the compilation. It wasn't even picked to be the record to take off. I mean, you know, nobody knew back then anyway, but I think the first release, like, it was a single, was called Members of the House, and that came out. And then Big Fun was just taking off and on its own, just because I was releasing it on my label, and then it just started getting exposure and it became the record. So I ended up signing a deal because I couldn't control pressing the record. People were booting the record because I couldn't keep up with the demands.
Yeah.
No way I could keep up with the demand of that record at the time. So I decided to sign it to 10 Records, which was affiliated with Virgin Records. And Inner City was born. We had, you know, we this record it was monstrous. 88 in the summer, through the summer in England. And I would go to England because at that time, it was the beginning also of, you know, me early 80 was the beginning of me doing remixes.
Yeah.
And so I would go back and forth, you know, to England. And I was just experiencing it through the summer, and it just made people so happy. And just never seen anything like it. It just touched my heart. So
was that when you were in the UK, were you hearing it at like festivals? Were you hearing it at clubs? Were you hearing it on the radio? Like, what was it?
I was hearing it on radio. I was hearing it on pirate radio because they had pirate radio. I was hearing it it was a Monday night at Spectrum's, which Paul Oakenfold, it was playing. It was the biggest record of the night. I was hearing Pete Tong play it. I was just hearing it everywhere at a place called Astoria. It's mainly clubs. You know, the festival thing, I didn't get to too much of that beginning secret festivals at that time, but I know that was going on too. It was
Did you ever go to any of the free parties, the free raves in the UK at that time?
Nah, I never made it to none of those. Never made it to none of those. But did some raves later that were quite huge and big tents and all these people. But that was the beginning kind of in a city. And I brought James Pendleton over so he could experience it. He actually was supposed to be in the video. He wasn't in the video. I brought Santonio over. We all was over there mid-summer, something like that. Just because, I wanted him to be a part of the success. I wanted Santonio, since we was working together, to get some extra inspiration, see what was going on. So James caught chicken pops. He was supposed to be in the video, so I replaced him with Santonio. So I don't know if you ever seen the video Big Fun. It's got me and Santonio not knowing what the hell we supposed to do, but take our arms and do this rave dance and let Paris be the star she was. But it was quite interesting because Paris was working at, I don't know, some makeup shop or some mall, like in the makeup section, makeup and perfumes and stuff like that. And I called her up and I was like, Paris, they need you to come to England to do the video because Big Fun is taking off. She didn't comprehend that at all. She was like, I ain't coming to no England. I ain't leaving my job. I got a job. Not knowing the magnitude of this record is huge. Now, I don't know if it's nothing about no hit, but I just know it's huge. Now, it's not released at the time. So
was this pre-release?
Oh, yeah, this is all pre-release. Oh, wow. It hadn't even released. So that's why they wanted us to do the video, so to get ready for the release. So it didn't look like she was going to come. So I had another singer that I knew from Detroit. I flew her in to do the video. But 2 days before, Paris said, I'll come. So now I have the other girl there in England, and thinking she gonna do the video, and then Paris decides, of course I gotta go with the original singer because she wrote the record and she is the voice. So if you look at the video also, you have two singers singing, one in red and one in yellow. I didn't so I let her be in the video and they kind of shared parts, but Paris was it the lady in yellow, and she eventually became obviously the complete singer of Inner City. So we had that success. Big Fun became a hit. The record company's like, oh, we need you to do a follow-up. I ain't used to this kind of stuff. I just make music and put it out whenever. So now I'm under the gun.
I guess you tell me if I'm wrong, but when was this, in the late 80s?
This was, Big Fun came out 88.
Yeah, so you must have been 80. Like one of the first techno DJs that was actually having commercial success.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
no doubt about it.
So you have zero idea what the fuck's going on.
I have no clue. I was going with the flow and trying to make adjustments on the fly, and it's a lot of moving parts for me, but I'm with it. I'm learning as I go.
Yeah.
So they need this follow-up. So I called James. I said, James, we got to do a follow-up. Because to me, he's going to be a part of whatever I'm doing with Inner City. James, he kind of became missing in action. And I didn't see him didn't hear from him. So I just had to go ahead and finish Good Life, you know, created. So then follow was Good Life. And I thought like, okay, well, let me make it sound like it's from the same family. Yeah. And she wrote, you know, Big Fun in Paris wrote Good Life. I did the music, sent it to her. She wrote Good Life. And I was like blown away. It was like, wow, how could you come up with such a beautiful vocal to match this music? And the music was powerful too. So I finished that. And at that point, once I finished that, you know, Good Life became a hit bigger than Big Fun. It was huge in Germany. It was huge in England. Same story, Top of the Pops, all these TV shows. And then at that point, I didn't have Paris signed to any contract. But Virgin at the time, they wanted, now because of success, they wanted an album. And that's when we formed. It was me and Paris. Yeah. You know, I hadn't heard from James no more. So I just moved on and kept developing in the city throughout the years. And, you know, people don't probably know this too. We were the first band out there performing our music, techno, house, electronic, like our style live. Mm-hmm. So I actually had to hire band members from Detroit that actually lived in the same warehouse space I lived in. And I met these guys, Tommy Onyx, Dennis White, and they were live musicians.
I didn't know Dennis was that far back with you.
Oh yeah, Dennis. They had lots of non-sleepless nights because our studio was right next to where they stayed. Especially my DJ booth with a big ass subwoofer, and I would chill it, and they would be right there, you know. But we never had no issues. They just, you know, we all did our music. They have a band playing. Sometimes you hear the band, and they hear this thumping kick, you know, just all the subs coming through. But that's how I met Dennis. Dennis became my band leader at that time, and I met Tommy through Dennis and the rest of the guys. And I said, hey, I need to do my music played live. There's no way I knew how to play music live. I could play my sections and obviously studio musician, sequence, computers, whatever. You can, you know, that's how we created it. But taking it on the road, couldn't take no studio on the road.
It was
impossible. We were the first to go out there and do this live too, and full band. So we did it in London, Germany, Australia, did it many places. And it was different for me because it's like being in a studio, you know, you had a drummer that, you know, had more of a live feel because it was live. You know, I played stuff like the octopads, little sections that I could play eight bars, you know, because I didn't go to Berkeley and all that. Like all these musicians, but I had the ear and I knew how to get it done, you know, and I was having success. So so we were the first to do that. People, you know, they have no clue. And it just evolved over the years where groups were able to do it through technology and technological innovation. Let us, you know, be where we are today doing it.
Well, it's also amazing with Big Love and Good Life, like how those records still get played.
It's amazing. It's amazing because, you know, here we are, we're talking, you know, years later, you know, from inner city. It's 35 years from my label, but Good Life, Big Fun, they came shortly afterwards, so it's 34 years ago. So here we are, and those records for younger generations. Now, of course, they've been reshaped, recreated many ways. Some people have licensed the right to use parts, etc. But, you know, they've been in commercials, they've been in insurance commercials, all kind of stuff. So I go to Australia, and we performed there not too long ago, March. We play in March. We do our first tour in a city in years there. And I do this festival called Pitch Festival. Pitch Festival is like hipsters, young, who, you know, all that type of vibe. And so it's going to be interesting because, like, in a city, we go back way back. And, man, it was just amazing to see how that crowd gravitated towards our music. And then obviously Good Life kicked in and they just lost it. And I'm thinking, like, And they sang in it, you know, they sang in the song. And I'm thinking, like, you know, you got kids out here 18, you know, 21, and they singing Good Life like it's a hit to them now. And it's been around so long. And, you know, that I think the wonderful thing about our music, you can recreate it, reshape it, even though the original obviously is the beginning. But through all of this, it allows different exposure to different generations, and the record will be here when I'm long gone. It's going to be around.
It's pretty special. I love that.
Yeah.
What was it like when you started going overseas for the first time and then seeing the success kind of not necessarily be in America, but be overseas? How long did it take till it got to America for you?
Overseas was, you know, first of all, going overseas was really tough. You know, we had to go to the trenches because there was no internet. Mm. You know, you had these long flights, you know, they had TV screens that you had to look way in front of you, and we had to watch movies that was just, you know, whatever. Everybody had to watch the same movie.
Yeah.
And then, you know, first class for us, you know, we had to, you know, suck it up and just get there. So first of all, that was tough. It was depressing. It was really tough because you had to be in this place that you didn't knew no one, you know, even though you're having a success and you know, you're doing these shows, you know, you get homesick, you know, there's a lot of homesick at those times. You didn't, like I said, there was no internet. There was nothing to really do. And I'm kind of a loner, you know, I like to be with myself, but at the same time, you know, I like to do stuff, you know, but it was cool with the success, seeing different cities and experiencing that. But it was tough times as well to be away from home and, you know, try not to run up a phone bill of 1,000 pounds, which I've done a couple of times in the beginning. You know, you're on the phone, you're charging like five pounds a minute, you know. So, but the success was worth going over and to be able to do something you love doing. And then you had to go to different countries where, you know, I don't speak anything but English. So now you're hearing different accents and trying to understand, you know, people. You go to England, you know, you got different accents within the countries. And, you know, especially when you go to Scotland, now you're trying to understand the Scottish, go to Ireland. And then you like, you got to say, can you say that again? And you know, stuff like that. It was always an adjustment. And then, but that was all a part of it. And the success, obviously, it was good to see, you know, how we were having success. And at home, it took a while. I mean, yeah, Big Fun and Good Life cut through. But as far as our music as techno, the whole Detroit scene, you know, Detroit was pretty good. America, you know, they didn't really know about us, you know, when the countries, you know, I got some plays, obviously. New York was pretty good for me because I crossed kind of both paths. Chicago was booming for all of us. Chicago was great. And then all of a sudden that market just seemed like it just died. It just like somebody pulled the plug, you know.
What do you think that was?
I really don't understand how it just, it was so big. It should have just kept growing because it was not just, it was big in the gay clubs, big for blacks. It was big for whites, it's especially Hispanics. They all were into it. They had these radio stations, WGCI, BMX. And it you know, maybe it was too much and people, you know, but I don't know, you know, still great music coming out at the time. And, you know,
was that when hip hop got really big?
Now, hip-hop was parallel. Yeah. I will say that. Hip-hop wasn't, you know, we were going parallel. And, then, you know, then hip-hop did take off. And the advantage that hip-hop had that we didn't have as a collective was hip-hop had the streets.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
And the visuals for video and that connected to the street and hip hop, you know, they talk about whatever, you know. It wasn't always positive, let's not put it that way, but it connected to people because of different situations.
And well, a lot of people could relate to it as well at that time, right? And it still is the case, right? I think the thing with dance music is a lot of it doesn't even have any vocals. Electronic music and a lot of it's just repetitive beats. And to the masses, repetitive beats is boring, and it's like, what the hell? Why do you want to listen to this? Until you put it in the concept of a nightclub or a rave or something like that,
or festival, or right,
yeah,
and the whole thing. So yeah, so you know, we had our struggles, and then being black artists, you know, even though blacks only listened to our music when we first started, it shifted. It was blacks to all whites, but we lost the black market. The urban market, because of hip hop, kind of took over, and then there wasn't enough artists and visual size. I mean, okay, you had Inner City, we was on the Apollo show and all kind of decent shows here in America, but you know, it was only us really. A few groups followed, like Crystal Waters, CC Peniston, but it wasn't enough to collectively engage enough of the black side. So we kind of lost the black side. The Europeans were inspired by what we were doing and created, you know, their own movement, kept it, you know, going. But the sound changed, you know, because people have different inspirations, and everybody ain't gonna create like me or Derek or Juan, because, you know, it's within your own vision. And, you know, and then you had people just in it for the money, just trying to find a way to create a brand to make money, you know, market artists. And, you know, so we didn't have the same success. And a lot of producers like Paul Oakenfold and different people, especially Sasha and Digway, they came over here a lot and were, you know, they were getting the big parties where we really wasn't getting the big parties. And, you know, that progressive sound and trance sound started getting kind of taken over, let's put it that way, scene. So, you know, that was a little tough to see, you know, not that I'm against any music, because, you know, it's good music in all styles, no matter what. But it was, you know, a little difficult to see that, you know, we you know, all of a sudden, you know, we don't get the press in America. We didn't get the press and the support of Americans, but the Europeans would get that, you know. And it was like we're a little bit lost, even though our innovation and our creativity was always there and our talents was almost second to none. But it wasn't about that. It was about capitalism, some races, especially in America, that was against us too at the same time.
Did you find that was kind of replicated in the UK and Europe as well?
That you mean when you say replicated,
just the part of, did you, because obviously you guys were touring in Europe at the same time, and places in the UK. And did you find it was there came a point where there was like a switch of like it, the trance scene kind of came through, and then you guys were kind of out for a bit?
Yeah, it was. I mean, besides the really underground purist type of club, mm-hmm. but as the scene started growing, yeah. the raves started growing. Then you had this breakbeat scene that took off in the UK, and then yeah. you didn't have a record team like that had a breakbeat, then it wasn't cool.
Yeah.
It's just because that was like, that was it.
Yeah.
You know, very English sounding too. So, you know, there was a connection there from the English to the other for people that were from England. So there was definitely a point where we even in the UK, you know, we didn't get some of the huge gigs that you felt like, and I always felt like, you know, you could play music. It's up to the promoter to bring the talent in and figure out how to mix the genres or mix different DJs amongst, because then you're educating people not just one way, but then you get stuck in the one sound one way, even though it's all dance music.
Yeah.
You know, you have to find a way to bridge the talents. It's up to the promoter, but every promoter don't take chance like that. They want to be safe one way, and it's all about money to many of them, you know, back then especially. So that was part of the issue.
I feel like we're kind of in that stage again right now, though, if I'm honest, where it's which I totally understand, and I don't have a major issue with it. I have an issue with it to a certain extent, where it feels like, for me, dance music, electronic music, whatever you want to call it, is about community and kind of bringing people together, and kind of introducing people to interesting new artists. And I feel like the whole capitalistic side of things, which we're all a part of, if you know what I mean, I'm a part of it. I get booked and all of that. But I feel like it's very unimaginative right now. And that it just feels stale and stagnant. But I can imagine for where you've sat, because you've been in the industry for so long, you must have gone through many periods of feeling stagnant as an artist and kind of going, what the hell is next? Like, how do we kind of progress, and how do we, what are those like lows of an artist like for you, especially at the beginning when there's nobody to look up to kind of go, oh well, they've done this and they've kind of had a dip and then come back and had a dip. Like, how does that even like affect you as a person?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think my philosophy is, you know, you just got to keep going if you believe in it. Everything goes in circles too. That's a real true saying.
Yeah.
You know, come back around, and you got to creep. You got to find ways to try to recreate yourself. And it's not always up to yourself. It's up to how the scene moves and how. But I always find good music finds a way. You know, it still finds a way to cut through. And that's why we've still been around so long.
Really?
You know, you know, I don't know how many genres it is now, but back then, you know, it was only house. It was only techno and then tech house. And, you know, it shifted so much. But what I find is like a lot of the younger generation start out one way and then they find their way over, you know, at some point. And it's, you know, that EDM was the entry point at one point.
Yeah.
And trap and all that. You know, what you want to see is events, you know, like, you know, movement and festivals that genuine to the music and bring different artists together that will help be innovative to the scene. And production is important, environment is important, where you place this events, and you just want to see more stuff like that happen. Europe has done a pretty good job of it, you know. You know, in Detroit we have smaller clubs, we don't have really a super club, but you know, it's still I think a good enough scene to keep it going without burning it out. And then you have this great festival. So, and, you know, I experienced obviously Cross Festival, over in California.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did a few festivals lately in America that seem like some of these are not just going one way. They're combining stuff and, you know, making stuff more. So that part is good. I think people just got to continue to be educated, got to keep at it, letting people know history, because connecting to history is still important. Yeah. You know, it's not like the most important thing in the world, but there's a connection that people can grab a hold to, it helps.
Well, I think it's also, sorry to butt in, but it's still so, it's in the grand scheme of music, electronic music is still so young.
Yeah.
And like I can still speak to you, right? If you know what I mean, like where you're one of the creators, and that you don't often get that in many genres of music in life. Generally, you don't often get that. And I think it's like really special for us to be able to have that now and to kind of still educate people about that rather than go, oh, it's too late. If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. That's the beautiful thing about electronic music and this creation of dance music. You can be 40 years younger than me, but we still connected. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that it's not even about age. You know, it's about the connection of creativity of music and the path that we've taken musically that everybody can kind of connect to at some point. You know, usually like people who watch like some of the older acts, even back in the time, like the Rolling Stones, this is, you know, they get the same audience, the same fans forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, we might lose some fans, but we're always gaining fans or gaining people with interest that's much younger. That's why this, you know, it is young and it will continue, you know, it'll continue to probably be that way. You know,
It makes complete sense. People at a certain age stop going to raves. And they have families and they get married and they do other things and don't want to spend the weekends in a dark room. It's totally understandable, but I think it's amazing. It's an amazing place for escapism for the youth of today, of every generation.
Yeah. And then it's positive. It's not like you see fights and people, you know,
getting shot and things like that. You don't get any of that.
Right. That's what's so amazing about it. So it's it's positive. You know, you get sometimes you get people wanting to shut clubs down and, you know, stuff like that and festivals and saying it's, you know, it's a bad thing, but it's really not. It's actually it gives people an escape and it, you know, I think music helps save people lives. Actually,
yeah.
You
know? 100%, man. 100%. I had MK on the podcast a while ago and I'm good friends with him. Toured with him over the years, and I didn't realize how influential you were in the early days of his career. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm really interested to get your side of the story.
Mark, I remember Mark, you know, this young kid coming to the studio and you know, just trying to find his way, make his path, you know? I mean, he was very, what's the word? Just motivated, and he had all this talent to make music, you know? So, you know, we started letting him in the studio because, you know, my door was pretty much open for almost anyone to come in. I let people use my studio.
Yeah.
All kind of artists came up, Shaz Demir, Ron Trent, everybody came to my studio just about. Obviously, Derek had his own, Juan had his own, but we were all in the same corner. But, you know, people gravitated to me that was inspired by me or liked my music. So at some point, Mark was, you know, a bit of a protege of mine, not completely, but he was inspired by me. I let him be around me. I took them on road trips with me. I put them in videos. I did a lot of that type of stuff, you know. And of course, I love a lot of the music he was making, and I released some of it, and, you know, some records I didn't release, and, you know, but I remember particularly Mark making music, and I still lived, like, I had, my studio was connected to where I lived. At the time, I just lived in the loft, and I would, like sleep next to the room that my studio was in. It wasn't like it was soundproof. And I would hear Mark making his tracks. And, you know, sometimes I have to wake up and just tell him, like, keep that line. Cause sometimes, you know, you might get rid of something. Hot. So yeah. I remember those days trying to sleep, and it's just banging. It had glass on the door, and it was just rattling, but it was some good times, you know, back then. But he traveled the world. I think he was inspired a lot by my remixing, and, you know, I don't know if you know this, I was the first one to do a remix how we know it. Oh, like, yeah. Back in the day, remix was like Shep Pettibone and Jellybean Benitez and all those guys. They re-edited and they did extensions of records to make them like a single. They would make it so it would be for a club DJ so they could play it, have a better intro, a longer break, stuff like that. Yeah. But that's how remix worked back then. So I was the first one to strip everything and put all new music to it. So, you know, we should have had a different name than a remix for it. It's really like a reproduction, a reproduced record, but I was the first one to do that. And MK, he was around when I was doing a lot of that stuff. Yeah. So he was inspired by my remixes more or less than anything, I think.
Wow. I didn't know that. When you talk about remixes, was there any remixes that you did that kind of like, because back then remixes were huge, especially with like the likes of like Madonna and kind of like the big pop acts.
Right.
What was the point? What was it when, was there like any artist that you kind of got to remix that you were like, how the hell am I remixing these people?
Yeah, they're definitely some artists. Like even New Order. I was like, because I was playing Blue Monday and stuff like that back then. I'm thinking, like, you know, it was a different record. I think it was called Round and Round.
Yeah.
And it wasn't one of my better remixes. And, you know, it was a very difficult record to remix, you know. But I did it, and, you know, it came out, and, you know, people liked it, you know. But I was, to do them, I did Yellow. I did a record. It's called The Bottle, but it's by the Christians. It's one of my favorite remixes. It wasn't the original Bottle, but it's one of my favorite records. And I got to remix that. And, you know, that was amazing. I did Paula Abdul back then, too. Not that that was like I was dying to do it. I just did it. Yeah. But it was a slow record. And I took it and sped it up and, you know, made it like a normal BPM because it was too slow. You know, it might have been 110, but I made it like 125 and had to do all this vocal processing to get the pitch right for the tempo. But I, you know, did a lot of remixes, tons of them back then.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And sometimes if it was the right path to take, giving so much away, you know what I mean? But that's what it was. Who knew?
Yeah.
And, you know, you live in the moment and, you know, you get in this big studios. I had a small studio, you know, 8 tracks, whatever, you know, a few instruments, synthesizers. You get in these big studios, you can get anything you want. I was working out of the Zomba studio a lot, and you got these big boards, SSL boards, and you can get any kind of equipment in there. So you know, and then they give you like, it's different than it is today. You know, they say like, okay, we give you 24 hours a lockout, or you give you 48 hours to get the mix done. So whatever you did, you had to come out.
Yeah.
You had to get it done and be done. And that was the remix, you know, no matter what. It wasn't no recalling and stuff. You just get it done, make sure you was happy with it. So
that's
a lot of that back then.
When the process from going like analog in the studio to digital. Was that like a kind of interesting switch for you, or was it kind of an innovating time where you were like, okay, we can actually do a lot more?
Yeah, it was innovating and interesting for me. I always was one, the forward think and try to use technology and like to see it develop so it wouldn't become stagnated or boring, or, you know, you always want to be inspired to create. And, you know, sometimes it's only so much you can do with one piece of gear. But even though the most important thing is to be able to maximize and master that piece of equipment, but, you know, if you do that, then you get to the point where, you know, you feel like you need another tool. And these tools definitely help. And it started really, a lot of it started with DJing, even moving over from, you know, as much as I love vinyl, you know, records getting lost. I went to Australia twice and my records got lost. Even the first set I played in Australia, I had to go buy records because the records never made it in time. So that was terrible because it's like, and I'm talking about back in 1992 or whatever, you know, you just couldn't find what your set was. There's just no way. It was impossible. So,
yeah, because also back then in Australia, I can't imagine the record stores being as good as they were in America or in Germany or the UK.
Not at all. So, you know, so stuff like that became frustrating. I remember having a gig in London, and I told the it was at what was it at Ministry of Sound, I think.
Yeah.
And I wanted to fly me in a day early, but they refused to. And guess what? I flew in the day of like normal, and like they requested, they refused because they didn't want to pay extra night at a hotel, which to me, you know, is ridiculous. But I did that to have a precaution just in case my records would get lost, because I wasn't carrying records and big crates on board. So anyway, my records get lost. It don't show. I'm in London, no records, that, you know, and then I get in later. So I can't even play the gig. So eventually technology started changing with, you know, even like Final Scratch that ended up turning into whatever Traktor now.
Yeah.
I was right there at the beginning of that technology, loving it for the fact that not only, you know, you can have your whole set, but, you know, you could play. You know, you don't have to carry records. So worry about your records getting lost, because, you know, a lot of that tore up, you know, our backs and necks and shoulders.
Yeah,
you know, even when you carry stuff on board, you know, that was, you know, difficult. We feel that now more than then, even though it was tough then. But now, like, you know, I'm glad I stopped hearing all that as much as vinyl, you know. And then you had people talking about, why are you not playing with vinyl, you're using this technology? This is, you know, you had the haters too. But so I was always supportive of innovation. And then, you know, as plugins and all, you know, the digital world came in, especially like with editing. You know, I used to edit back in the day, you know, you got a reel, you mix your tune on the reel to reel, and then you got to sometimes you make sections because you're doing arrangements. And if you didn't have like SSL or something that remembered all your mutes, you know, then that's how we did it. And then you have to edit together and splice, actually physically splice the tape and create, you know, the space to make it, you know, bring it all together. Anyway, that was a nightmare sometimes, because if you sneezed or something and you lost a piece of tape, it's on the floor. It's happened, trust me. And, you know, so the fact that some of the first technology was, I think it was called, I don't know if it's called Sound Tools, but it was an editing, two-track editing software where you could, you put your track in there and you can splice it up right there. I was like blown away, like, yes, you can actually edit like this, and then you can do it so much quicker, you know, than trying to cut it, and you can seed it, you know. So I was right there sold on technology. And
I
then
that.
I just kept evolving with it and started using computer DAW systems, moving over to that, you know. I remember the beginning days of Logic where, you know, you had to create all these environments. It was a pain in the ass, but that's what it was back then. But it was innovative too, because, you know, you really had to use your brain and to create these environments to get to the creative mode.
Yeah.
But once you did that, you know, and it's been a process over the years, but And it might be a little too much stuff out here. Like my son, he always got something new he want to show me, or a program, or you know, some new technology. Sometimes it's a little too much, you know. But it's down to the individual and the producer to decide what to eliminate or not try at the time, you know, because you know you still have to move forward, and you got to know how to be able to get stuff done. You know, that's important, instead of being like 20, 30 different things and 100 different plugins, yeah. And you kind of not nowhere, you know, at the same time.
Limitations definitely help in a creative environment, for sure. I totally agree with that. Yeah. How is it watching your sons grow up and be a part of the industry whilst you're still a part of the industry? And also, one of the boys is in a city, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dantes is in inner city. And the reason he's in inner city, because I thought, like, since I have a new singer, not the original singer, because she retired and we took a hiatus. And then Dantes works with a lot of vocal music himself and likes vocals and like writes chords. And he sounds like me in many ways. So I thought, like, this is a good way to keep inner city going, and it's something I can pass on to him. And if he wants to keep moving with inner city in the future, you know, it's there, and he kind of helps keep that part going. If I'm traveling, he could be, you know, he doesn't travel as much as me, of course, so he can be working on, you know, new projects, and I can give him direction, and he can do it. So that part is good. And it was something never planned, you know, even though they've been into every movement from when they were kids, every festival, they haven't missed one yet. And then to see them be a part of it and to be a part of the industry, how it happened, it wasn't because, as I said, you guys are going to make music or you guys are going to be DJs. Dantes, Damari, I think, mentioned it to Dantes. Dantes moved with somebody when he was 18. Like, he moved out the house and moved with some friends, and they were DJs. And that's how he got inspired. Amazing. He got inspired by somebody else and started making music. And here we are today. So it's good to see that that's what they love, you know, and that's what they do, you know. I didn't make it easy, you know. Sometimes people think, you're just riding off your dad's coattail. No. A lot of times they came to me, asked me, how do you do this? I say, go look it up on the internet. Go look up on YouTube. I would, because, you know, I wanted to see if they were really interested or if they just trying to. And I didn't want to be asked dad every question about everything.
Yeah.
You got to figure out some stuff, just like I had to figure out some stuff. And you got to put some time in. And once I seen that and I believed it was genuine, then I started being more, you know, supportive. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And helping them and giving them decisions. But, you know, the studio never stops with Dantes, especially, you know. It's like, it don't make a difference. As you heard earlier, he was playing music off his computer upstairs with a little speaker, because even if he ain't in the studio, he's in the studio somewhere.
Still
working. Even if it's on his laptop, he's always creating. So it's good. And, you know, they love it. So, and they, you know, I know they, you know, both have talent. So
that's awesome.
Hey, keep it moving.
They're lovely guys as well. It's nice to see them out and about in Detroit and kind of popping around shows. Yeah. It's really interesting. I want to talk about Movement, because this episode is actually coming out the week of Movement. So it's kind of perfect timing to have you on as well.
All right.
It's a special festival for me. And this year is the first time I've actually played in the festival itself. I played after parties for years. But now, it's kind of like Detroit's. I moved to Detroit 5 years ago. And Movement's always been one of those festivals where I've always looked up to want to play and always wanted to play. And it's the kind of the one festival in America where people talk about outside of America, in the electronic kind of music scene. How was it you've been to every single one. Obviously, it didn't start as Movement, it started as Dempf. Let's talk about kind of how it all kind of came about.
Here's some history on this festival that some people know, and you know, there's been some documentation on it and stuff out there, but you know, this original concept came years ago. I'm talking about 1997, 98. Carl, Derek May, and I think Kenny Larkin, we formed this organization called CKDK. And it was supposed to be, the purpose of this was to do events, grow our music collectively together. But, you know, we kind of always still pretty busy, and it wasn't moving at the pace, let's say, that it should have, because, you know, we're in different places and it's just not coming together like that. And but anyway, so at one of the meetings, Derek brings in Carol Marvin, who was the original producer of this festival, of them. And the thought was, the concept really came from Derek and Carl about doing an event in Hart Plaza. So we had this meeting, you know, and it kind of was forgot about, at least, you know, from what I remember. But then, like 2 years later, a year and a half later, Carl sends a message to me or says, guess what? I'm going to do the festival at Hart Plaza. I'm going to be, you know, the artist director, and, you know, Carol Marvin is going to produce it. I want you to support me and perform. So I was, you know, so my first thought was like, well, I thought we were supposed to be doing this together. But Carl probably said, like, it's never happened if we're trying to do it together. Yeah. So it happened, basically. And Carl got support from all of us, Derek, Stacy, whatever, whoever, all the Detroit artists. It was a free festival. There was all kind of problems with the Detroit, the city. But let's say in the end, it happened. Yeah. And it was a big success. It was a beautiful thing to see people come out and embrace the music that we created that inspired the world to be come back home in our own city. And it's the perfect location. So it happened. Carol was around for whatever, two or three festivals. She fired Carl. There was a backlash against all that. You know, Derek went into the city along with some other partners, lawyers, et cetera, pitched the city to do the festival. At that time, the city was paying Carol Marvel a certain amount. Maybe they gave her $500,000 or $600,000, let's say, to put on the festival. So even though with that money, there were still challenges putting it on at that time because it's quite expensive to run.
Yeah.
Anyway, Derek used my name, Carl's name, in this proposal. In the end, we ended up supporting it, but we really wasn't a part of it. So Derek kind of did it with the mindset that we were all going to come back together.
Yeah.
But Derek, you know, not really being a businessman, even though it got accepted, the people that were involved at that time were not really honest people, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to cut some of this down. On top of that, we was really dealing with some corrupt people within the city.
Yeah.
The festival happened. It was free still, but it was a challenge to get money. So the festival, the first year happened, Derek lost a lot of money, whatever. He was doing it because he thought this was the future.
Yeah.
And it did become the future. But it was, you know, sometimes it's not good to be a pioneer or be at the beginning because you got to go through some bumps and learn. The second year Derek had the festival, Derek came to me. This was 2004 that he had it. He came to me and said, Kevin, I'm going to have to cancel the festival. I don't have enough money. I'm out of money. I'm broke. I put everything into it. This was like 2 weeks before it was supposed to happen. I came up with some money, kind of helped save that year.
Yeah.
Became a part of it a little, but not really. I was just name-wise, I was connected to it.
Yeah.
And it happened. Okay. Again, not enough money. Money was lost. Not enough sponsorships. The next year, I took it over, 2005. I produced it. I was the first one. You know, I was the first one on a lot of stuff. It's amazing how this happens, but I guess that was my path, my blessings to be. I was the first one to get the city to allow for that venue to charge. So there was that, prior to then, there was no festivals. And that was always part of my vision. We need to charge for this.
Yeah.
So it got approved kind of at the last minute. I wasn't told, I was told a few months before that I got approved to do the festival, which was challenging. Because imagine trying to pull this all off in 2 or 3 months is tough enough doing it by the year. But me traveling the world, you know, trying to, you know, run a festival, it was difficult. Anyway, the festival happened. At the end, we was able to charge. Didn't really have a gauge on how many people come. I brought actually Jason in, the Paxa House guys, yeah, run one stage. They did very well. I brought my family in to help. There was some corruption going on with the city, with money being taken.
Yeah,
it's just some crazy stories. I won't get too deep into it. The festival happened. Basically, I was heartbroken by it because of the corruption. I was just destroyed that we do all this hard work. The city begged me to do this festival because I almost said no.
Yeah.
And then to see the corruption go on and see how greedy people were. So I just resigned.
Yeah.
I just said, I'm not doing this festival no more. I'm not going to be a part of it because I didn't want to be a part of unrighteousness. Mm. So that happened. Jason took it over. And through the process, here's the great thing that happened for the city. We had to go through all of this, but this is why the festival is still here, because Jason was able to take it over. He was able to see some of the pitfalls and find a way to deal with the city. And they're here all the time. They're not traveling the world like us artists, yeah, you know. Yeah. Not that we weren't businessmen, just you know, you have to choose your path.
Totally.
It's either home and travel the world and run this festival, or do what, you know, yeah, our creative natures was to perform and play. So anyway, they took it over, and it has evolved over the years and gotten better in production, and obviously been able to charge a lot more than back when I charged. I charged $10, you know. I mean, really, I charged $10. That didn't pay the bills either.
No, I can imagine.
You know, so you know, years later, I got back involved with just with curating the stage,
yeah,
which is a lot simpler, you know. And then I perform.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what I've been doing is branding it as origins, because it's the past, present, and future. I mean, believe the talent should mix on my stage. And, you know, it's not one path. It's not just techno. It's not just house. It's not, you know, it's a combination of artists that I brought in before, like Kink, Patrick Topp, and obviously Detroit people.
Yeah.
And obviously performing this year on it. And it's KMS 35 years. But it's evolved, and it's a great venue, and they've done a fantastic job. You know, you can never make everybody happy, you know, but I think they've done a fantastic job. And I'm glad to see that you're on it.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. Thank you for having me, man. I appreciate it. And it's amazing, because the first time I was in Detroit, it wasn't at Movement. But I think like the third time I came to Detroit, it was for a Movement party. And it's amazing. You know, more than anybody, the struggles Detroit has kind of gone through over the years, from the race riots up until even today, like how much the city's gone through. And that weekend is the one weekend where, to me personally, the city just comes alive. And it's busy everywhere you go. You've got every venue, every promoter, and like external promoters kind of feeding off Movement, because there's so many people in the city. It's just a really special moment for the city. And I think having that really brings the community together for Detroit as well.
No doubt. I mean, it brings an influx of people, influx of money to the city, and creativity. And it's a magical moment that, you know, we wish happened more.
Yeah, totally.
You know, or like to see that, you know, you don't even see that in other places. You might see people come together and money being made, and, you know, but it doesn't have the same vibe. And, you know, definitely different.
There isn't another festival like it that I've been to, that kind of you have that city feel. Because I think every other city that festivals are in, the cities are amazing cities that have like lots going on anyway. And like Detroit, I remember moving to Detroit downtown like 5 years ago. And even then though, like there wasn't a grocery store down there. And this is 5 years
even
ago.
Then?
Yeah.
Come on, man. When I used to live in 88, I was like, I can't find grocery. I got to go out to the suburbs.
Exactly.
It's 5 years ago, and it was like that still?
Yeah. It was still like that for it. Like, you could go to restaurants and you could do that, but there still wasn't the closest grocery store was Whole Foods in like Midtown. Like, So yeah, it's a really nice time to see the city kind of come alive. I got a couple more questions.
Yeah.
Batman.
Yeah.
How did this come about?
Well, you know, I did a publishing deal and a label deal with a company called Armada.
Yeah.
They're from the Netherlands. And, you know, one of my goals is hopefully over time is to evolve into doing or get my tracks more in films. And I, you know, you see these films, you hear electronic music, and then sometimes it's just the worst electronic music, you know. You'd be like, what? How did they pick this track? Or why did they let somebody create, you know, a track that represents our scene?
Yeah, which, totally.
Cool. So I always would put pressure on Armada saying, you know, you guys need to do a better job or really be progressive about trying to get tracks into films. So they basically found a way to make it happen and deliver, you know, really on a top movie, you know. And that's one of my things that, you know, I want to do more of in the future and, you know, eventually get myself into, you know, doing some proper scoring, you know, for films. You know, I feel like it's a way to evolve, but it's still something I love, and it's still something that is needed in films. And why not, you know, have something authentic from some of the originators, as well as it doesn't make a difference as long as it's good and it fits the film and the future. It could be from anyone, but it needs to be represented in a proper way. And I just think like that's the future, you know, of music. It should be, if that's what's going on in our scene, it connects with the youth, it connects with people.
Man. I agree, man. I totally feel the same. How was it when you first watched the film? And
you know, I love Batman. So, you know, I was just looking forward to watching it and obviously seeing how they place my track. And then you never know to the very end. So I was so quiet about it, you know. And I was almost a little nervous about it because, like, they go through, you know, this was like a 7-8 month process at least, maybe longer. And, you know, you go through different stages, you know, where, you know, you got to make the final cut or this cut. And even when you're in the final cut and you say, okay, you're in the final cut, you just still don't know until you hear it, really hear it. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so I just was there waiting to see if I heard it. And I kept waiting. And I was sitting in an area in the movie. And I didn't know, they obviously, it was more in the background than up front. So half of my hearing is already gone. So I'm like, listen, is that the track? I think so. My mother came with me, my kids, and they was like, is this the track? I said, yeah, think so, but it was the angle I was sitting on. It was weird hearing it like that, but at the end, you know, I looked through them credits. I said, yeah, Yeah, I was in here for sure, you know. So, it's good, man. Just looking forward to some potential more opportunities. And, you know, it's enough sci-fi films or films that can use good dance music.
Totally, man. You know? Totally agree. So let's wrap this up. But I've started doing this thing at the end of the podcast where I've asked people a question, and just to kind of end it off nicely. And it's not necessarily based about music, but it's more so about just life. And you've had a lot of experience in life. And I guess the question is what piece of advice would you give somebody today about life?
Try to be righteous as you can in your heart. Treat people with respect and, you know, just do what's in your heart. That's the most important thing, and you'll get your blessings.
Love that. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on, man. It's been a pleasure to catch up, and I'll see you this week.
Soon.
Keep safe, man. See you soon.
All right, my man.
Peace, man.
Take care.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yep, yep. Bye-bye.
And that's a wrap. Big thanks to Kevin for coming on. Go follow him. Make sure you go check his music out if you haven't heard his stuff. It's amazing. Go do some history lessons as well. He's done a lot of stuff over the years. Keep safe. Share it with your friends. Much love.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.